You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
Welcome back to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast with myself, Owen Walker. This is the second instalment of the conversation on the approach to major incidents with Keir Rutherford and Alec Wilding. So in the second instalment, what we wanted to do is really look at these triage tools which have just come into practice, which is around the 10-second triage algorithm and indeed the major incident triage tool. We're also going to look at enhanced levels of care on scene and what should be done with the casualty clearing station, and also looking at how we manage our emotions as senior clinicians, both on scene and retrospectively. And what I wanted to do as well is just look at how we manage and indeed look at working with interdisciplinary teams around the fire brigade and indeed the police on scene. So welcome to the podcast, Keir and Alec.
Hi both, good to see you again.
Yeah, morning. Thanks for having us back.
So we could just pick up where we last left off and indeed just look at how triage tools are changing. So Keir, if I could get you to speak initially and then Alec to how you see triage tools changing fundamentally.
Yeah, so I suppose from experience, we know that one incident isn't the same. And that goes with the same with kind of the presentations of each patient at each different incident. And so we got this kind of multitude of patients, you know, kind of certainly say from Grenfell, there were patients with smoke inhalation. Then you might have one incident like Westminster Bridge where you have lots of patients with blunt force trauma. And then somewhere like London Bridge where you have patients with penetrating trauma. And so I suppose, you know, when you're looking at triage tools, triage is going to be kind of one of the first kind of clinical priorities in a kind of multi-patient incident. And it's really happening before kind of the real, obviously, life-saving interventions are being undertaken. But in terms of kind of any more extensive care, that triage is happening before that process. And the idea really behind triage is to identify those patients who are the sickest and require life-saving interventions to keep them alive. I think why we've had a recent change in triage is that kind of looking at what we've been using perhaps in the past hasn't been particularly accurate in identifying patients with requiring life-saving interventions. But also perhaps is that, you know, people, as we discussed last time, that people might not necessarily be using them to how they should be. But it's going to be difficult to kind of shoehorn all different clinical presentations perhaps into one tool without it becoming really complex. And the more complexity you add, people are simply not going to use it. So it needs to be simple. It needs to identify patients that require the right care at the right time. And it has to have an acceptable under and over triage rate. Simplicity is probably going to be the key. I think that's probably my take on it. Alec, do you?
I think triage, exactly as you said, is a pretty blunt tool. I'm not entirely convinced that it does need to change. I think I know we're going to talk about it in a second, but 10-second triage and MIT, I think, is, you know, it's a really good piece of work that's come about after quite a long time. It's changed the practice that's been the standard for a while, and there was absolutely a need for change. But I think, as inherently in its nature as a blunt tool, I think it's easy to overcomplicate what triage is, and it's exactly that. It's a very fast snapshot of exactly what you're dealing with and these different modality of injuries. I think, you know, it's the simplicity, triage will capture all of that. I think if anything, talking about triage tools changing, maybe this is a good time to start talking about the role of enhanced care teams or APPs or CCPs at these types of incidents. And I think we touched on it before, but often in the first 20 minutes of an incident, these things can almost be like a an oil tanker, once they're sort of they're set on their trajectory, it's very difficult to slow them down or change their direction. But having clinicians with extra skills, perhaps extra knowledge, who are more used to working under stress, they're able to see the bigger picture and try to find those patients. I know, Kia, you've talked about before the P1 plus, but able to find certain types of patients who will benefit from certain interventions. And that could be a case that I know, looking back over some previous incidents, trying to think of some good examples now, but I'm sure at London Bridge, I can certainly think at Westminster Bridge, there were already some people on scene doing some really, really good things. And it was a case of, I think for me at least anyway, I saw my role as supporting and empowering really good practice that was already taking place, and perhaps seeing things that needed to be done. I wasn't an APP at Westminster Bridge, I was a team leader, but turning up, it was very clear that there weren't many ambulances, but being a major incident, lots were going to be arriving. And again, it was from training that I knew that actually the bronze parking role was probably the most immediate role that would need to be undertaken. So whilst people were going over the bridge, triaging people, finding an appropriate place to have ambulances park up and keep crews together, give their keys or touch base with one of the ROs, so that it was all in an organised manner, so lots of people didn't park up everywhere. Little things like that. But it's all there's so much variability, and it's all so much case dependent, that I think it's kind of why triage needs to be simplified, so that it can capture all of these different types of incidents, because they're all so different. I told you I'd say exactly what you said, but in a much more much more waffly way.
Owen, what was your experiences, obviously we're some time now post 7/7, about the kind of triage and its use back then to perhaps what it is now?
Yeah, so I believe that actually we were probably doing what we're doing now covertly rather than overtly. So although physiological markers were playing a part in the explicit triage, actually it wasn't happening that way in practice. I think we were looking at subtle or indeed explicit markers of injury, so unconscious, extensive thorax injuries, and indeed just the mechanism of injury irrespective of the physiological markers. In 7/7 we were never taking, I was never taking respiratory rate or indeed pulse rates. You know, they were either conscious or unconscious with blast injuries, with profound burn injuries, and they were easily identifiable as priority one patients. There was I suppose in essence both at King's Cross and indeed Aldgate, there wasn't this explicit let's take the respiratory rate and pulse rate. It was they made themselves overtly clear as priority one patients. So I and talking to other people from different major incidents, it seems to be that was the case from the Croydon tram crash. There, you know, going through, there wasn't these physiological markers which were being monitored. They were explicitly priority one patients from marker or injury. And so I think what it's done is it's probably reflected a true indication of what really needed to happen, what does happen at scene, what needs to happen at scene. One of the big things I took really from being part of the advanced paramedic scheme, as well as London HEMS, was just this adage of triaging together, because actually it can change, it can be dynamic, but actually it's really good just to test your decision making in the moment and have, you know, in the Croydon tram crash, you know, a couple of our colleagues just went around and triaged together and dynamically bounced right priority one, priority two, priority three, priority two. And actually it's really good just to be able to bounce that out off another colleague and then move sequentially quickly through a carriage or quickly through a scene. And I think let's come on to the TST and the MIT tool now, because what it is, the 10 second triage tool, it's clearly got, it's meant to be done rapidly. and make rapid decisions. And then the major incident triage tool may be in a more extended version at some kind of holding or casualty clearing center. But if I could get you guys to speak to the TST and the MIT, because in my perspective, it's what always should have been happening. It's always what was happening. We've just made it explicitly clear that this is the preference now, and we've got empirical evidence to back it. Is that both of your experience? Because Keir, you've pressure tested it in simulation quite recently. How did you find the interplay?
I thought it was good. I think having kind of read around it, listened to your podcast with Claire, and I suppose having had experience of triaging patients in multi-patient incidents, it feels a lot more in tune with probably what happens, certainly TST, around actually what happens in the real world, and probably more likely to be used. And I think it's got a lot of benefits in terms of certainly early on, it can be used by any member of the emergency services. It's taken the kind of physiological elements out of it. I like the fact that both of us well have removed the need for the under 12s that you're then having to use the triage tape, which, like we discussed before, that perhaps if you're not regularly practicing with triage, that in itself might be difficult. But then having to then start triaging children with a very different kind of modality tool might add extra level of complexity into it. But yeah, I think it's good. It's obviously not been used yet in the kind of real world kind of major incident. We've not brought it yet into London, but I know it's going to be coming. And like you say, TST is quick. Whether or not anything will come out of it in the future from major incidents, I think there is the discussion in there that anybody that's kind of involved in the major incident that is still alive and walking will become a P3. They won't move patients to that survivor reception center as before. But so then you have the risk of creating a huge amount potentially of P3 patients, and probably people that find themselves in such a incident in the future are going to have to think critically about how they manage that patient cohort. And I think there's a really kind of strong argument that, you know, we talk about advanced practice and kind of enhanced care and critical care, but, you know, certainly in the involvement of urgent care teams, you know, kind of ECPs or urgent care APPs to come in and manage that cohort of patients and bring in some kind of senior level decision making around their care, I think it's going to be really important. And looking at TST, I suppose, kind of post London Bridge, and kind of, I still think that the kind of cohort of patients that are walking are and I come at this with probably a biased experience, really, that seeing patients at London Bridge who were essentially probably running for their lives at the time had very significant penetrating wounds. And then some patients being walked out of Borough Market later by the police who, again, had significant chest injuries, but they were P3. I mean, they weren't P3 patients when you assess them. But I do think there is still that risk of under triage in certain situations, certainly around penetrating trauma and early into an incident, that they will be under triaged. And it's interesting, I wonder whether or not, if they were ever to review TST, whether or not the penetrating trauma section is moved higher up than where it is. And it's a co-assessment with walking patients. I do, however, like the fact that they've included packing into the hemorrhage control. I certainly, coming from my practice, I can't remember the last time I put a tourniquet on, but I know working in London and seeing kind of dealing with lots of patients with penetrating trauma, as well as the open fractures that sometimes we go to, is that I pack wounds not infrequently to gain hemorrhage control. So I think that's a really important step to have included. And potentially those patients might have been missed in the past because it didn't stay tourniquet. But yeah, that's my kind of take on it. I think if we were going to look at enhanced care, just going on to that kind of just before I kind of round up, is that you do need some nuanced decision-making about patients. And that's where your kind of critical care teams, your critical care paramedics can come into play. Because not all P1 patients are the same. And some patients that are maybe P2 are going to have more complex needs than other P2s. And that might be around things like analgesia or limb reduction. But there is a risk to the P1 plus, and there is a risk to that kind of decision-making by senior clinicians, is that the risk there is that those clinicians need to be experienced, and they need to be experienced with the cohort of patients that they're managing. And there's very little kind of really published around this. Some of the Israeli case series or publications that they've reported on have looked at anatomical triage by doctors during explosions within Israel. But what they've said is that to be effective, it needed to be by doctors that were used to dealing with blast injury. And there's a case from Japan. It's one of the worst attacks using a bladed weapon. It happened a few years ago at a facility for disabled people, in which I think it was about 19 people were killed and above 40 injured. And a lot of patients, because the triage tool that they used didn't necessarily match the patients that they were dealing with, they ended up over triaging a huge number of patients. And when they actually looked later on about how many of those patients really needed life-saving interventions, it was far fewer than what were identified. And perhaps, you know, if you're making that kind of nuanced decision making, you do need to know the patient group, because I imagine in Japan, in the patients they were managing, that cohort of patient they weren't maybe necessarily used to seeing. So there is a risk to it. But I do think it's really important. But the risk is if you over triage lots of patients thinking they're P1 plus, those true patients that are, and by that, I mean the P1 plus patient being the patients that are going to die on scene in the next 20 minutes, 40 minutes, the patients with significant airway problems, the patients that have, you know, non-compressible hemorrhage, that are actively bleeding to death, and that if they don't leave scene urgently, they will die on scene. These are the cohorts of patients we're talking about. And the patients that perhaps, you know, those identifying them through things like the Hateful Eight, and kind of that they're kind of looking at their trajectory of how they're deteriorating, perhaps over 5-10 minutes. That's the cohort of patient I mean.
And Alec, what's your perspective on Kia's answer?
Yeah, completely agree with everything that Kia says. You know, I think just listening to you talk then, Kia, makes me think about those patients from Manchester that were within the cohort deemed to have potentially have had preventable deaths, either, you know, compressible hemorrhage that weren't compressed just due to medical equipment on scene, or time to definitive care, or those with uncompressible hemorrhage. And yeah, I think, you know, again, talking about the role of enhanced care teams, APPs, CCPs, doctors within, desperately trying not to get dragged into the zonings of major incidents, but, you know, to where the sick patients are, let's just say that, and be able to identify and treat them with that higher level of experience, knowledge, exposure, all those sorts of things, used to working under stress. I think this is what hopefully 10-second triage will facilitate. The other standout strengths from it that I really like, it's probably a good time as well just to sort of recognise the authors, you know, Claire Parks, Sean Harris. I think they've really taken the time to qualitatively extrapolate data from people that have been to these incidents to help them shape the new triage tool. It's been a big piece of work, and I can speak to that firsthand. But the other standout strengths of 10-second triage, I think exactly as you said, Owen, I think in these really, really high stress situations, to use the example that's perhaps more familiar with our practices, AVPs, CCPs, paediatric arrests, we tend to try to double up jobs. So when it comes to drug administration, checking the correct dose and then administering it, in an ideal world, we would try to put two clinicians together to do that one task, because we know that it's stressful. It's 5 o'clock in the morning. It's highly emotive. These are the times where we can either make errors or find ourselves under a lot of stress. So it's a really nice way to mitigate that, is to double up these roles. And, you know, we said it before, we're lucky in London that, you know, you press a button and typically we're we're quite quickly well-resourced for these sorts of jobs. But I do think that is my experience from working out in the counties, and it's only very recently, is that actually, you know, these are the resourcing situation, it can be replicated. Like, I've done jobs recently where there's been, if anything, it's been over these, you know, big multi-patient RTCs, if anything, have been over-resourced. So, and the other nice thing about 10-second triage is that, exactly as you alluded to, Owen, you can split with other emergency responders, and hopefully it will enable our colleagues from the emergency services who typically have probably really wanted to help but not known exactly how they can. We can now form these small flash teams of a police officer and a firefighter, or a police officer and an ECA, and they can go around and triage and be that much more effective as a two, hopefully mitigating mitigating the stress, and be that more effective as a team. Whereas typically this sort and sieve would be done by two ambulance service clinicians, which isn't the optimal way to manage your resources. So I think that's really good. I think the other bit to 10-second triage that I really, really like, that's finally kind of put to bed, is this bit about resuscitating if resources allow. So typically with triage, if it's a declared major incident, I think people would go down, which anyone who has who's had an airway opened, correct me if I'm wrong, but has had either some central adjuncts or some basic airway manoeuvres, they're still apneic for a period of 10 seconds. They would be declared, if it's a major incident, they would be declared dead. But now, obviously, with 10 seconds, and I think we look back, I can certainly think at Westminster Bridge, for example, there's actually only one patient that I can think of, but he actually certainly had some resuscitation. That was before it was known the sort of the true extent of the situation, and it was declared a major incident. Up until that point, he was given a decent level of care, and the crew is really, really tried. But then there was that gear shift. I think someone had said that it had been declared a major incident. But actually, in other situations, we talked about this before, I think, at Brixton, you know, at the Brixton Academy incident, there could have been the option to sit in the car, to not go in for safety reasons, or to go in and say, actually, these two people are in cardiac arrest, this is a major incident. But, you know, to have the resources, and that might be from the ambulance service, that might be from using members of the public. I think it's much harder now. I think you'd be really, really hard pressed to think of many situations where we were actually overwhelmed to the point that we didn't have some resources to at least attempt some level of resuscitation. I think it's nice. I really, really agree that it should be in there. It makes it less ambiguous as to what to do with this cohort of patients, and if anything, maybe there's a nice, and hopefully I've not seen the training package for 10-second triage, but maybe there's a nice follow-on piece of work here about how to best use members of the public who are trying to help, and how to support them, and what's appropriate to ask them to do, and how to do it in a certain way. And I know this is kind of things that we might do in our day-to-day work, but even things like communication to then get the best out of your responders. Go on, Keir, you know something?
I think it'd be interesting to see, with both having a TST and a MIT, that on an actual kind of real world incident, whether or not people do move on to MIT, or whether or not TST is just used. And that'll be an interest, because you may find in certain situations, depending on kind of what's happening or scene safety or kind of stress levels, that actually TST is easier to use, and actually people then just forego using MIT. But we don't know. I imagine MIT will be used, but then to how extensively will be interesting.
From your experiences being at these sorts of incidents, how much were members of the public helping, trying to render care, being used by the emergency services either to attempt to extricate casualties? Is that something that both of you found on these sorts of incidents and that was helpful?
Yeah, I think probably from a number of incidents, I've been pretty blown away by what people are willing to do. I think what you have is certainly in certain situations where the people remaining are kind of members of the public that are willing to kind of go above and beyond. And they certainly, you know, when we talk about, you know, there's that whole conversation about, you know, they are the first responders. They are the kind of initial kind of filling of the care gap. And if you generally ask people to do something, they will do something. They're normally really sensible. They're normally willing to help. And they've also, it's interesting, like they've invested in somebody as well. I think that's really something that I've taken from it, that people will spend a long time with people. And that I struggled with some of that post, certainly London Bridge, just about some of the scenarios that I found myself in during that, and the interactions with people that had invested so much kind of time with people. I remember those people, but obviously I've never met them again. I don't know, what about you, Owen? What's...
Like you said, people, I think people are a lot more invested than you think they will be. And there is, I think, to that adage, like you said, Keir, it's about being grateful and showing them gratitude for that level of care, because they might have blood on their hands, literally have blood on their hands, or indeed their clothes. They quite often, majority of times, don't get follow-up from the patient they've cared for. And so having that kind of gratitude and thanking them and some kind of verbal affirmation, I think, is key, because they are heavily invested, and it's taken a certain amount of courage to step up. So it's consistently surprised me as well, actually, in the past. From that, I'd just like to pivot actually from that question, or indeed that statement, just is how you both deal with your emotion, both at the scene and retrospectively beyond the scene. Because I, you know, viscerally, in we've all three spoken about this, you know, this level of stun at scene, you know, first responders coming to scene. I think this happened at a number of major incidents in London, where first responders arrive on scene and it's so catastrophic, so chaotic, that there's this almost fight flight and stun kind of level, and some clinicians can find themselves just utterly stunned and utterly startled, almost a startle effect. But I suppose my question to you both, and Alec, if you'd like to go first, is about how you deal with that kind of, maybe that amygdala hijack initially, and then retrospectively how you maybe assimilate some of these emotive cores, and how you sort of dissect them in your own mind and or with other people.
Yeah, definitely. I think, again, being used to work, having worked in London now for a while and been in the AVP program for the last 5 years, I think I've definitely picked up all my little tells of when I know that I'm feeling stressed, or this is going to be a stressful job, or it's going to be emotive. And I think it's, thinking of recent experience, it's drawing on lots of little tips and tricks that I've learned through like our governance process or training opportunities, going out and doing shifts with colleagues, and just talking about this stuff, where I've picked up ways to focus when you're feeling stressed. And I remember somebody giving me a really good tip, and it was finding an opportunity, or for some reason to, and there always is, to step away from a scene or from something to go back in and see it with a fresh pair of eyes. And it's that moment of clarity. It can only be a few seconds, and there's always a justification. For me, normally it's a big incident. It might be to do a windscreen report or a cethane or something like that. Some quick comms with the desk is a really good opportunity to just step back, step away, and once you've taken that information and giving a nice structured report, so your colleagues on the desk know exactly what you're dealing with, and then going back in with a fresh pair of eyes and thinking, right, okay, what do I need to do, and you know, going around, walking the scene, trying to get as much situational awareness as possible, speaking to colleagues, trying to support clinicians or responders that are carrying out certain actions. You know, I think that's so important. Little things, knowing that when people are stressed, their first sense to go is often their hearing. So even a soft, you know, engage them physically, a hand on the shoulder or something like that, just to let them know that you're there. There's more people there that are there to help and support. And then going around and looking at what people need. Little tips and tricks like that, and kind of putting them all together, but at the same time trying to not allow myself to get sucked in clinically, become clinically focused on any one patient until a point that's appropriate. I think that's a real fine art, and that's the real challenge on these jobs. We talked about it before at the Brixton Academy incident. It was a minimal number of patients, even though it was a very dynamic scene, and I felt that it was appropriate and needed to become patient focused very quickly, try to resuscitate the people that were there. We talked about it earlier, there was a sufficient number of resources with police officers are all doing excellent and trying their absolute best, giving really, really good standards of care. And everything else that was going on, I knew there were lots of people in the way who were going to be able to kind of mitigate and deal with that. And we still had your focus is split. You're kind of trying to do multiple things, but that's okay. And you know, you're only as good as the people around you. I'm a big believer of that. And it's all about working together. I think that certainly during these sort of complex high stress incidents, that's my kind of approach to it. I think afterwards, yeah, it can feel different. I think I'm trying to think. Westminster Bridge was very surreal. I remember coming home, and the one thing that I wasn't prepared for that felt very unusual was the media coverage and how it was all over the news. Like, you know, I went to the classic ambulance service post big incident type thing. I went to the pub with my flatmate, and we sat down and just to have a pint, and it was just there on the TV screens all over the news. And I thought, there was even pictures of me, and I thought, this is very just odd. That felt strange, and I didn't quite know how to feel about that. And obviously lots of messages from people and on my Facebook and things like that, people sort of reaching out. And I think a lot of it, there's an awful lot of it, Kieran and I were talking about this before, I'm sure a lot of it's come from people genuinely want to make sure you're okay and want to reach out and all the rest of it. But you always, and maybe it's perception, maybe it's me, but you always feel there's that little bit of morbid curiosity from other people too, and not knowing exactly how to have those conversations. Or, you know, I think the really nice thing about working in a small group, in that APP group, is that you're working with people who have been in these situations, they've done these incidents, they really understand, and to be able to share experiences and feelings post incident, our case review process is a really excellent opportunity to talk about this stuff. We had this last week with the very sad case in Wimbledon, but a really good opportunity for everyone to talk about things and again extrapolate learning. What would I do in the situation? You know, was, and people, I feel, genuinely wanting to know, is there something that someone else would have done? Is there something I should have done differently? I think that stuff personally has really, really, really helped me deal with those questions that you're left with about yourself. You know, I think I'm my own worst critic, and I can come away from things and spend a long time deliberating over things that I did or felt maybe I should have done or didn't do. I think to have that opportunity to discuss these things with peers at that level, but have it be also so supportive, to me is gold. And I wish we could replicate that somehow on a much wider level for everyone else, but I appreciate it's pretty specific. I know your other question was around ceiling of care, and I can't, you know, is there a mindset shift with a limited ceiling of being able to offer a ceiling of care on scene? And I think what I was going to say was, I actually don't think there is or there needs to be. Certainly there's, you know, I think maybe the only thing is pain management. Sometimes but then we've got, you know, now we're bringing in Penthrox as a great adjunct that can be self-administered. So I think even things like that now, I don't feel, I've certainly not come away from any incidents where there's been multiple patients or it's been a major incident or a significant incident feeling that I've had to compromise a level of care with a patient because we've not been able to, we've been under-resourced. I actually strongly feel that nearly all of these incidents, we've been able to do all the things that we needed to as and when, nearly always. So yeah, I don't know what are your thoughts on that, Keir. Is that something that sort of rings true?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, some of that stuff that you say there really resonates with me. And I think going back to like being able to talk to in a small team, it's really interesting. Like we're talking about major incidents and like kind of like, you know, all the staff. But actually, you know, what we're now talking about is kind of like, you know, kind of how you're feeling and emotions. And, you know, I think one of those really important things is about how, you know, kind of having the vulnerability to actually be able to talk about those things. I mean, APP has really taught me, and my whole career has certain sections of it, and there's certainly sorts of kind of defining moments in my career that has taught me about how you control your emotions and stress. It's really important to how you function and critically think. And, you know, often now I'm kind of left thinking like, you know, arriving at scene to certain jobs is, you know, how am I controlling my stress and how do I control the stress of the team? How am I going to kind of mitigate against that stress developing within that team so they can function as best they can? And I think something I really learned, London Bridge was a really defining job for me. You know, it's I learned a huge amount about myself personally and as a clinician, and kind of something I kind of worked through afterwards and kind of probably about a year later is that that actually, you know, sometimes you respond to a major incident, you find yourself in something that's still evolving. And that's a very different place to arriving 20 minutes or half an hour later into an incident that is more established and there's a structure in place. And they're both, yeah, and they'll impact you in different ways. And like, at London Bridge, this kind of thing I've really realised is that, you know, kind of APP and you're a solo clinician and you go to some really challenging stuff. And like the thing that I always think about is like you get a job and it's like half an hour plus old. And on our MDTs, we get all the call signs that are unseen. And then you get this kind of like row of different call signs. And you look at the job and you know that there's something happening there that you've been requested to go and help assist with. And you're thinking, this is going to be difficult. It's going to be challenging. And, you know, in your mindset, you know, things start kind of like doubt starts creeping in, or like kind of imposter syndrome, or just, you know, depending on how you're feeling, like if you're feeling tired. But, you know, and I often think like sometimes driving to a job, I feel I'm like more me. I'm not like APP me. You know, I'm obviously concentrating on a good, safe drive. But there is something about a transition that when I arrive on scene and I park and I book on scene and then my right foot gets out of the car, I become an APP. And my arrival into London Bridge, that's quite a personal, I won't recount that story because it's quite a personal story to me. And I've obviously talked a lot about that kind of first few minutes and the experiences of that. But it was hugely stressful. It was a hugely overwhelming situation of noise, of kind of stimulus. And I remember kind of driving around. I stopped just by Stony Street outside the pub after they just tried to attack it. And the police obviously then arrived and then shot the three attackers dead. So I was quite close when that happened. And then drove around the corner and to be kind of met by this very chaotic scene. And I was probably pretty much at the brink of my kind of stress level breaking, really, but was kind of like, you know, trying to kind of bring myself back from that with using different kind of like techniques I've used. But it was all, this was all happening so fast. And I declared the major incident from the car. And then, like I said, you know, my right foot hit the ground, hit the road, and then I was an APP and I went into that mode. And it's I think a lot of major incident training lacks focus on this. And, you know, we talk about process and procedures and triage and structure, you know, like the CSCAT model. And but actually, are we really preparing people for the true reality and what you might witness or experience in these jobs? And what is that first 20 minutes like? And the chaoticness of it. And that first 20 minutes is really important, because like what Alex said, is like, you know, it's like a, once it gets going, it gets going. And, you know, like some of the small decision making that can be made in that first 20 minutes is absolutely crucial. You know, about like, you know, is everyone turning up and dumping their ambulances on the road? Well, that downflow stream, that's going to cause an issue with ambulances leaving scene very quickly with sick patients. And I think, like, for me, it's how you deal with that stress is key. And I think I'm going to kind of quote the Greek philosopher here, Socrates, and is that you have to know thyself. And lots of people have interpreted that in different ways. And I think, like, what I've really learned as an APP is that you have to have some emotional insight into yourself, and you have to know yourself, and you have to start to develop a lot what triggers your stress and what happens to you when you become stressed. And then when you know that, you can start looking at ways about dealing with it. And because I think you can choose how you react. So I think, like, there's a split second when you become stressed or you become angry, there's a split second that you can decide how you respond to your emotions. And in that second, you can either go down a path where you say something you don't want to say or react in a way you don't want to, or you can draw it back and make a positive decision about how you're going, what you're going to say and how you deal with it. And that allows your ability to think. It stops you from becoming overwhelmed. And I've definitely fine-tuned that over the last few years. And I think kind of Alec has touched on Brixton Academy. And I think, like, from some of the incidents that I've been involved in over the years, I've really been able to improve my resilience and about how I control things. And, you know, it's accepting that when you arrive, it's going to be stressful. It's going to be chaotic, but I'm not going to be drawn into that. And I'm going to deal with it. And no matter how much we can try and control the scene, it's going to be stressful. It's going to be chaotic until we've got enough resources from the police, the fire service, the ambulance service to start gaining some grip and control over that scene. And I suppose some of the kind of methods that I use for myself is like, you know, Alex said about the kind of your hearing going, but, you know, we know about as your heart rate gets higher, you lose the kind of fine abilities of your kind of like technical skills. You might stop being able to think properly. So kind of, yeah, just concentrate on your breathing. You know, there's all the kind of box breathing or the tactical breathing that people talk about. But I think generally just taking a few deep breaths. And I think also taking an overview and not rushing into a job. And I think kind of over the years, I've seen people that have turned up at really difficult jobs and people have rushed in and they get consumed by what they're going into very quickly, and that set them up really. And I think just taking the time to kind of survey the scene, what's happening, what are people doing, what are other clinicians doing, is it calm, is everyone in a flow state around what they're doing, or is it very chaotic, is it very stressed? And it's a bit like doing a primary survey on a patient that kind of allows you then to kind of make your decision making around the flow of care that you're going to provide. It's a bit like reading the scene. How am I going to go into that? And the big one as well, like for me, I know when I'm getting stressed because subconsciously suddenly I've called a timeout and I'm group huddling with everyone, and that allows me just to reset. But I think, as I said, you know, Socrates said, you have to know thyself. And when you can do that, you can start perfecting about how you deal with stress and build your resilience up. But you also have to be in those challenging situations and expose yourself to those challenges to start building your resilience up. And I think that's going to be an important step in how people then perform.
I think that's an excellent example, Keir, of, as Alec was saying, building these off ramps into an incident whereby, yeah, stepping away, doing some comms. But like you said, fundamentally, you have to know where and how you're performing to be able to say actually to yourself, right, I need an off ramp, I need a timeout, and build those into, and as you said, the aggregation and the escalation of an incident, you might need to build more off ramps into there. But you've said something really powerful about this sort of cognitive switching of, you know, just the right boot hits the ground, and maybe in the US it might be the left boot or the whichever side you're driving the car. But it's there's lots of cognitive switches within our day, and I wasn't really going to go here, but I think it's really prudent too, because there's a cognitive switch for, yeah, like you said, right foot hits the ground, I'm now an advanced clinician, or I'm now going to set the tone. Rather, you know, you're going to be the barometer for the temperature. You're not going to be affected by the temperature. So you're going to start to hopefully de-escalate the scene, de-escalate yourself fundamentally, and then start to get a semblance of organization. And it's also a very different cadence of change, like you said, when you're in an active situation versus the adage of turning up 20 minutes later as a fifth or sixth resource, when you can start to see things more objectively and you can start to see the pinch points where you can de-escalate certain members of staff, but also extend empathy to those first responders that might have still been there when there was very much an active dynamic scene, when there might have been an active fire situation, or indeed a kinetic situation that needed to be that someone's born witness to, and you can start to extend empathy to that. But coming back to the cognitive switch piece around, there's cognitive switches when you end a shift as well. And one of our colleagues did say that when they finish a shift, they take their shirt out and they maybe just untuck their shirt from their, or they put their car key into their car. And that turning of the car key means they're going home. And that mindset shift whereby the day is the professional day is over, I'm now back. I'm now Keir Rutherford. I'm now Alec Wilding. I'm now a father. I'm now a brother. I'm now a something. You're something else. And just, but having that cognitive shift so that you can both just de-escalate your own emotion, be who you are, and actually shift pace and shift sort of the cadence of who you are as a clinician and as a person. And I think those cognitive switches are powerful. I think they happen subconsciously. We don't realize they happen, but they happen throughout the day in different levels. But it's prudent to acknowledge it, because if you don't shift pace, you're in this constant heightened sense of awareness and state of readiness. And there is no peace in that. There is no necessarily sense of de-escalation or indeed of being able to process information. And I think it's, you, when you said that, I've visualized exactly what you mean, because me, you and Alec have exactly been there, and your foot hits the ground and you turn into this different person. But I thought that was really relevant.
I think about what you say about switching off as well. It's like, after instance, like some of these incidents that we go to, is it's quite difficult to switch off after them. And I think it was like a week it took me to kind of like really come down off the kind of heightened emotions that I was feeling just from one night. And they're really difficult to leave behind. And I think certainly working in a critical care job where you then suddenly are back kind of to normal practice, where you're seeing patients in cardiac arrest, patients that are critically unwell or injured. And then like, I remember like sitting on the tube and people reading the Metro or the Evening Standard and seeing people that had died, and certainly people that I'd had contact with. And that kind of like, it then makes it very difficult to kind of process it. And even if you want to talk about it, and I kind of found that that was quite difficult. And I think Alex said it as well, is like, people want to come up and talk to you about it, and they're interested. But I found myself after a while becoming quite angry about that, and feeling quite frustrated that people wanted to kind of ask, because I felt it was more voyeuristic perhaps maybe than what it was. But I think that was because I was dealing with the kind of trauma of it. And I definitely, it left a trauma in me, knowing what happened to some people and, you know, the people that I kind of treated and their experiences about what happened to them, and the brutality of it, about what other human beings are capable of doing to other people. In a pretty kind of awful way, really. But yeah, I think kind of what I think something important that we haven't discussed is, you know, it was probably a year after London Bridge, I was diagnosed with PTSD. And because really it was difficult to shift, you know, I kind of hit London Bridge with quite a full, because of the work that we do anyway, with quite a full bucket. And I think London Bridge was a pretty, you know, it was a unique, pretty challenging situation to find yourself in. And, you know, we can't forget the kind of impact that has on people, on everybody that attends these incidents. And I was really fortunate because I was able to then kind of work with someone. I went for the type of counselling that you do it with. And she was superb. And she said, probably like her first thing that she said was that your job's unhealthy. And I was like, yeah, probably. And but she like, she taught me in such, she gave me these kind of like different tools and the ways to process things, that actually what you get out of it is like this kind of like post-traumatic growth. And I know, like, coming out of the back of London Bridge, I know that like what I am able to do and what I'm able to work through made me far more resilient and far more stronger as a clinician and as a person, really. Because I think, well, if my stress levels are capable of dealing with that, then I can kind of deal with most things, really. And so she kind of ended up going the wrong way, really, and making me probably more resilient and more, instead of just dealing with it, which at the end of it, she was like, ah, you're not going to leave your job. I was like, probably not, no. But yeah, she's cool. She's great. So shout out to her. But I think we do have to accept that people after these incidents will take a long time to get over them. And certainly the people early on into them, and about what you're faced with and the trauma of it. And I remember hearing someone give evidence, a member of the public, not from the emergency services, were at the inquest when I had to give my evidence and sitting in for the day. And I think it had been the first time they'd spoken about the event that night and how traumatic you could see that had been for them. So it stays with people. And I think anybody that have been involved in these types of incidents will probably recognise that. And I felt strongly for the people who had responded to Manchester, certainly when the report was published last year, about how that must have felt, because it gets dragged up again and suddenly it's in the limelight. And I think you have that kind of thing that people are judging you and that people are judging your decision-making. And also you can feel it might be kind of impacting your reputation as well. So it's a very difficult place to find yourself in. Yeah. And I don't think we talk about that enough, certainly in training and stuff. It's probably missed.
Yeah, thanks, Keir, for sharing that. I think it's so powerful, and to hear it from you as well, knowing you sort of from working together. And I don't think I've actually heard you speak so openly about London Bridge either, which is, you know, it's so important, I think, to share this stuff. And I completely agree with everything you said about knowing yourself, building resilience. I think we all go to work, we put on these masks, we put on this uniform. I'm an APP, I'm a HEMS doctor, I'm a HEMS paramedic, but you know, at the end of the day, we all have this inner monologue. It's about knowing yourself. I think that's so critically important. I think just to follow on a little bit from what you said there, I think this has evolved over time, but certainly doing the APP role now, and it's like, I'd say it's slightly controversial. my big focus on attending these incidents, these jobs, actually now isn't around the patients and putting the patients first. I'm a big believer. I have this, my own, you can call it the Alec hierarchy. I haven't coined it, but I have my focus is I put myself first, looking after my own welfare needs, empty bladders, full stomach, all that sort of stuff. But I look after myself and I make sure that I do what I need to do to be effective on this job as part of the team. I then put my colleagues, the team, on the next footing, because exactly as you said, and I think it's so poignant, we do this stuff reasonably frequently. We're used to working in high stress situations. We haven't turned up first. Having turned up first, as I'm sure you both have, to these big types of jobs, pediatric arrest, people that have been horribly burned, take your pick, big car crash. Turning up first is such a different mindset to turning up as an APP or in a HEMS team 20, 30 minutes later. And it's infinitely more stressful trying to unpack exactly what's happened, dealing with a million things. You have no situational awareness. It's really stressful. And I think, and it just really, really emphasizes to me the importance of, when I turn up to these jobs, my role is about looking after and supporting the team. Because as we said before, I think I'm a big believer in, you're only ever as good as the people around you. We talked earlier about being didactic on seeing Nick Brown taught me the art of front-loaded apologies, which is another one that I've always keep close to hand. So for anyone who's not familiar, if there's a need to be didactic on scene, Nick would offer up with a front-loaded apology and say, I'm really sorry, everyone. I'm going to need to be a little bit short because there's a million things that need doing in 10 minutes ago. Can you do this? Can you do that? Can you go and get that? And it's just having that humility and that understanding and compassion, seeing the bigger picture, understanding that people are stressed and not. I think turning up and shouting, losing that professionalism, losing your compassion, it not only not only do you lose the team, and to me, there's no bigger critical fail on scene than a CRM failure, than losing the team. That to me, almost, if the patient dies and it was something that we did or didn't do, we do a difficult job in difficult circumstances. Let's be kind to ourselves. Let's go away, learn about it, get better. But if I've done something that has lost the CRM and we've stopped functioning as a team, you've got nothing. You can't do this stuff by yourself. And I think, and to lead on to what you've said, I think there might, one of my other little catchphrases is that I can think, when I went to the, we talked about it earlier, the house fire with four children who sadly lost their lives, turning up to that quite early on, it was pretty clear early on that it would be very unlikely that we would be able to do anything for the four kids. You know, it was awful, awful, awful job. But it was knowing that there was always something that I could do for my colleagues and for the crews who were on scene, who, talking about the post-incident stuff and having been there and having listened to you talk about it here, you know, if there's any little thing that I can do, my role being there to support them and help them and make a really, really awful experience and awful job that little bit better, for example, that we were able to deliver really good resuscitation in a way that was as good as we could have all hoped. It's not going through the motions. If you're going to resuscitate someone, you should always do it properly and throw everything at it, but it's coming away knowing that we all did as much as we could do so that you're not left with these what ifs afterwards. And if hopefully I can help them get through a really, really, really stressful experience to help build resilience, we can all come back stronger. I'm a really big believer in that, and it's my big motivation to come into work every day. It's more about supporting my colleagues in ambulances who sit waiting hours and hours at hospital dealing with lots of low acuity stuff to then get thrown into some huge job like the ones that we're talking about. And I think it's having that, you know, and maybe this is, I'm going to talk about it, make a case for having critical care services within the ambulance service. This would be part of my big argument, I think, being embedded in the ambulance service, understanding the inner workings, understanding how our colleagues tick the stressors and be able to turn up these scenes and hopefully help. I think that's the benefit, not just for patients, because clearly there's a big case there, but just the overall dynamic of the team. And clearly there's an awful, as we've talked about already, there's an awful lot we can do for the patients as well that are really, really nuanced in care. But yeah, that's my, from what you said here, that just really, really, I think, really rings home to me, sort of, all of the reasons that I, you know, get out of bed in the morning and want to come and be an AVP in London or work as part of a HEMS team.
So I think just coming to land on the conversation, I think we could have a whole podcast about that, this actually, because there's so much to be said around the psychological resilience and coping mechanisms and or not resilience, but just the, like, sort of vulnerability. But just looking, I was going to probably roll two questions into one, really, around some of the inquest results and or recommendations around the way we change working within interdisciplinary teams and indeed how we get the best out of teams on scene. So I just wondered if you could both speak to maybe what's been mentioned within the Manchester bombing report, but also how we indeed do get the best out of teams. And essentially, like you said, Alec, these are flash teams on scene. These are teams which you would not necessarily meet in any other circumstance, because they're fire service colleagues or indeed police colleagues that are just rotating through shifts. But so, Kira, if you could go first around indeed what's been mentioned and indeed how you get the best out of teams, both in the ambulance service and from other services.
I think you have to start off with ultimately the kind of Jessup principles and understanding them. That's the framework that is there around how you work and how you function alongside other kind of interdisciplinary teams and also within the ambulance service itself. And we know from Manchester, probably one of the big learning points, but not just Manchester, but from multiple incidents, that things that have happened is because perhaps the kind of those principles haven't been kind of necessarily adhered to or stuck to. So it's probably worth just reiterating them, really. It's about the kind of co-location, communicating, coordinating, having a joint understanding of risk, and sharing your situational awareness, either through methane or the joint decision model. And the idea really around JESSOP is to ensure that emergency responders are trained and exercised to work together as effectively as possible. And that should be at all the kind of levels of command in response to kind of major or complex incidents. But I think it's really important to think that you know, I think some people, if you're kind of like, you know, kind of new into the job, you might just be thinking this applies to scene commanders, but actually I think it applies to everybody. And I think we keep talking about arriving into jobs early in that first 20 minutes, that if you arrive into scene and you're one of the first few resources and some police officers also arrive, you know, who might be from like one of the borough response teams, or actually using those JESSOP principles early with those first arriving police officers or first responding firefighters is really important, because it starts to build up a kind of foundation to how that incident is going to progress. Because if you're working together and you say to those police officers, because it's very easy for you to go off and do ambulancey things, for the police to go off and do policey things, but actually you've lost situational awareness of what everybody's doing. Because if you then come together and you say, right, guys, listen, what we're going to do, we're going to walk this scene together, because we need to gain situational awareness. We need to understand the risk. And then if you declare a major incident early, the police are fully aware of that, and they can then let their control room know. And if they do the same. And I think kind of interoperability is defined as the extent to which organisations can work together coherently as a matter of routine. And I think routine in that statement is the key word. And it's what you do day in, day out in your routine practice that either sets you up to fail or succeed. So it's kind of like, although it's building the relationships on scene, those relationships between different organisations, different teams, different clinicians, it happens in the days, months and years before you find yourself at that major or significant or complex incident. Because when you start to build up cooperation with people, you train together, you exercise together, you go along and give talks at their clinical governance days or their training days, you start to build up those relationships with people. So you start to get an idea of what their skill sets are, what their capabilities are, how different teams can be utilized in incidences, and what their expertise is, and how are they best going to fit into that scene. And I mean, you saw it, you know, in the city room at Manchester, you know, it was an APP and two heart paramedics were working together. Well, have they worked together before? Did they know each other? How was that interaction with one another? You know, and we've been really lucky, you know, and I have to give a shout out really to the EPRR and LAS Heart. You know, over the last 2 years, we've been invited up to go and train alongside them at Lincoln in the urban search and rescue. And that's not really around training APPs to go into kind of collapsed building structures, but it's about actually kind of two different teams going to learn about what each other is capable of doing. It's about breaking down boundaries. It's getting to know each other. It's building trust. It's kind of that when you undertaking that sort of training together, and, you know, then going in the evening to, you know, have a drink with each other, have dinner with each other, you're forging relationships. And at some point in the future, we know as APPs, as HEMS teams, we will probably be working alongside those teams at some point in the future at a major or challenging or significant incident. So if that's the first time you've met each other, if that's the first time that you've worked alongside each other, you're not going to be as maybe as slick as you would be. There might be misunderstandings about decision making or why decisions are being made or something that needs to be done. And when you know each other and the relationships have been kind of built and barriers is broken down. Your communication is far stronger. You're not worried about having that kind of like there being a breakdown in communication, or you have a better understanding. And I think ultimately, and I think what Alex said is, you need to know the people you work alongside. And that doesn't need to necessarily be around knowing them personally, but it needs to be about their culture, the team culture, the organization they work in, what they're capable of delivering as clinicians or as a team, that when you all find yourself in this situation, you can gel. Because ultimately, you know, readiness without training is not going to kind of result in good results. And it leads to kind of hesitancy, underconfidence, and lack of awareness.
And Alec, from yourself.
Yeah, I think just touching on lessons learned from inquests, I think everything that Keir said, and the only thing that I would add is that sometimes when we're all on scene, there are times when different teams, multidisciplinary setting, you know, fire service, police, HEMS, sometimes we won't all agree on something, and I think that's okay too. It's all about finding a way to work around these problems together, or to even work around each other. You know, because we're all, it's exactly as Keir said, it's all about trying to empathize and understand how we're all looking at different problems in different ways, from different services. But I think they, you know, the Jessup staff, that's definitely the key. Communication on scene, that's always the overriding things that's come out of inquest. Just to touch on what Keir said, there's a I randomly stumbled across this really fascinating leadership style, which dates back to the age of the sail, Napoleon and Horatio Nelson, and it's called the Nelson touch. And basically, scholars and historians have looked at how Nelson managed to defeat Napoleon, and they is exactly what Keir is talking about. They've coined this term, the Nelson's touch, and basically it was all about Nelson was pioneering in that he moved away from a very traditional, didactic, hierarchical way of working with his subordinates or his officers or his crews, and in fact more akin to sort of Henry V than Shakespeare. He would have dinner with them, he would see them as his equal. We talk a lot about flattening hierarchies and things like this is effectively what Nelson did, and ultimately it created trust. And I think that's what Keir's, you know, what I've got from what Keir said. I think, you know, it's about creating trust, having simple strategies rather than complicated plans, and the knowledge that you'll have these almost siloed little things that are going on, but everyone's working together under their own initiative. And maybe that's a nice sort of summary of what we've all been talking about, and how, you know, me turning up supporting, trying to support colleagues and seeing empowering people. Not that for a second I'm likening myself to Nelson, but I think it's all something that we can aspire to be like. I think it's, we often talk about this flattening hierarchies and all this sort of stuff, and actually what we're trying to get to is exactly that, which is creating trust. It's fascinating. It's still taught in the military. I randomly stumbled across it a few weeks ago and was reading it, and I thought, wow, you know, so much of this is still really, really relevant and really true to how we work. Maybe Nelson would have been a paramedic in 2023. Who knows? But yeah, well worth the read. Certainly next time I drive past Nelson's column, I'm thinking about leadership styles now instead. But yeah, just to throw that in, I thought it was really interesting.
It's really interesting you say that, Alec, because like you said, this decentralized command where you're empowering people to take initiative, but there's still healthy information flow. So there's information coming back, but you're right, there's empowerment to take initiative, to orchestrate care, and indeed to improve ownership. But the underlying foundation is trust. And you're right, this front-loaded apology, or indeed this even under stress, you can your tonality, your intonation, your level of communication can be like this, bringing things down, bringing the temperature down, so that there's this semblance of calm working. And you can start to gather the team together, irrespective of the external stress and pressure, which is upon you. And I fundamentally learned that as well from being in these situations. But everything you guys are both saying is absolutely key around really building rapport outside of an understanding levels of care and level ceilings of care and how people interact, so that when you're at scene, you've got an appreciation of what they do away from scene. And you've already trained together. And so you've already started to build rapport and understand that intercooperability, that co-location, that sharing. And it doesn't have to be, Keir, to your point about being simple, a simple S-bar or a simple ethane rapport to each other. Keeping it simple, right? This is from my perspective. We've got this many P1, P2, P3 patients. This is my assessment and this is my recommendations. What's your S-bar and what's your S-bar? And all three services or four services sharing simple S-bars and then reporting back. And then there's some brief action points or immediate action drills that need to occur off the back of that. But that simple communication, that simple information sharing, and then that sharing out to your own team is absolutely key. And like you said, this decentralized command is absolutely key. And I guess my last question, I want to keep you guys here forever. My last question would be around the florid human factors you see on major incidents. How do you mitigate, maybe just from a meta perspective, just a few central principles of how you mitigate some of these human factors?
If I was going to kind of bullet point some of those last ones, it's obviously knowing yourself and how you control your stress, and then also about how you can kind of your baseline knowledge and experiences and training that actually you can fundamentally put a plan into place. Because if you can't do those, then, you know, that in itself, if you're arriving at a scene that you don't feel prepared for, you're not going to be able to provide any sort of kind of leadership, because you're in yourself going to feel some inadequacies. So then that in itself will then reflect in your perhaps your leadership styles. But I think it's if you kind of successful leadership is or kind of clinical leadership is being able to adapt to your style of leadership to the scene that you're presented with, because you could arrive into a scene that actually is, you know, the team are kind of in a flow state, they have a plan, they're managing, they're doing very, you know, they're all over it. And then you could go in and try and exert, because you think you're the leader or you're the senior clinician, that you feel like that you then need to kind of exert that. And ultimately, then what you do is just create chaos. And then actually, you then kind of debunk the plan and then you actually create problems. So I think sometimes it's like one of the interesting things is sometimes that, you know, you might be a APP or you might be a HEMS team or you might, but actually at that point, sometimes you have to question yourself, is taking control or kind of taking on this role at this point, are we or am I the right person to be doing this? Or is there somebody else on scene who is more qualified and more experienced to be doing this role than I am? Because sometimes that might be the case. And I think if your ego or whatever is driving your decision making, then that might lead you to making some of the wrong decisions and actually leading to breakdowns in communication or into team working. So I suppose it's being adaptable. And again, I think we've touched on it. It's knowing your culture, knowing your people, knowing your teams, and having built up a reputation before. Because I think for me, it's like, it shouldn't be about like Alec arriving at a job or me arriving at a job or one of the others arriving at a job. It's a London APP arriving at a job or a HEMS, an LAA team or a HEMS team arriving at a job. And that prior to that, the work has been done that you built up your reputation and your culture. So when you do arrive at the scene, people feel reassured that they know what's coming and the decision making that you can make, and actually that you're going to fit, you know, within those teams. And it's all going to kind of hopefully smoothly kind of be smooth and have a flow to them.
That really resonates actually, Keir. And like you said, it actually acknowledging if a plan is working and people are performing well, just reinforcing that plan and affirming that plan and knowing to step back is powerful. But Alec, to yourself.
Yeah, it's been really hard following on from Keir because he keeps on nailing all of these questions perfectly. But yeah, I think everything that Keir says, and I think for the human factor stuff, I think for me, it's, you know, I think to kind of unpack the keeping things simple a little bit more, slow is less is more and slow is fast. I think when you're on scene, taking time to, you know, that little bit of physical touch for someone who might be stressed to come in, that reassuring hand on a shoulder, keep giving people one task to do at a time. I think really, really subtle things like that. Another big one that I really picked up from doing training with London's Air Ambulance is around co-locating patients. Again, when you're in these sort of mass casualty type scenarios, or even just with two, bringing them together, when you're, I think when there are opportunities to simulate or train these types of things, to have the opportunity to stand back and watch. And I say this from experience at our APP assessment, when people have applied to and come to our assessment centre to hopefully be successful and become new APPs. We've created similar sort of scenarios, if you like, and to watch, to stand back and watch and see how people would, colleagues would go about managing scenes with multiple patients. I think there's an awful lot to be said about that too, having opportunities to simulate this stuff and watch and see, because something as simple as bringing patients together and using, you know, really, really simple aids. I'm a really big believer that one of the best bits of equipment that we carry is a carry sheet, because just moving a person, it's not as, it's an art in itself, you know, carry chair, scoop, all the rest of it. But actually these are things that are, you know, are, as Keir said, knowing your people, the team, these are things that our colleagues are doing every day on a regular basis, using those expertise. And exactly as Keir said, I think knowing as well that perhaps you don't need to take control because so much good stuff is already going on. And actually, there's nothing better than being able to, for me, that the benchmark of a really good job is where I haven't had to do anything. You turn up to a cardiac arrest and actually somebody's talking to the families. There's ALS is well established. They've got a good grip on what the likely pathology is. You know, I've had a really, really clear handover. You know, not only has it made my job incredibly easy, and you're able to offer that first sort of opening gambit of what can I do to help? I'm here to support you guys. What, you know, whereas the flip side could be that you turn up, take over, bull in a china shop, throw loads of kit out of the way, start being really didactic, and actually you've not even just taken the time to come in and read the room and look at all the good stuff that's going on, taking that minute to absorb information, and if it is really chaotic and really dynamic, again, at taking, finding an opportunity to step away to quickly update the desk, perhaps, you know, quickly consider where you're going to place your kit or equipment, you know, try to walk the scene and see what else is going on and who else is there, and then coming back to the particular sort of area that's stressful. I imagine that must have been really challenging on 7/7 when you're in the tunnels or in a confined space. Certainly at Brixton Academy in the foyer, felt very, very sort of, you know, claustrophobic. It was kind of 360 degree mayhem. It's difficult to find these spaces, but it can be done. And I think make that a priority, understanding that, knowing yourself and understanding that need to step away, if that's what you need to do. We're only talking for 30 seconds, and there's always a reason that you can find that needs doing it. That comes to the desk as a good example. And then, yeah, one thing at a time. Exactly as you said, being mindful of yourself and working with who you've got there. And actually, I'm regularly reminded and, you know, regularly humbled doing the AVP stuff in London. You know, there's we work with some really, really brilliant people, and it's really nice to turn up to these jobs and see so much good stuff going on. It's great. It's the reason that I love doing my job.
And just to finish off, could we just look at some take-home messages for listeners, if possible? Keir, if you could go first.
So, yeah, fundamentally, I think it's to be prepared for these events as they come on run-of-the-mill shifts. I think for a successful response to a major or challenging or significant incident, it's about how the organisation, the team, and the individual responds to it. Because each influences each other, and without one, the others couldn't function. And I think this is really determined by the underlying culture that is developed within all of those kind of three things. And it's, by what I mean to that is, it's around seeking clinical excellence and around clinical care and scene management. And it's mastering the basics of those things. And it's then kind of reflecting on past experiences or what you have then kind of practiced and kind of debriefing it, taking out the key learning lessons and then implementing those lessons into your system. And because getting the basics right is really the foundations to high performance. Then kind of, you know, for individuals or teams, it's implementing things like Alec really kind of touched on this in the last podcast, is around implementing kind of major incident practice into your daily working routine. And that's by what I mean by that is by like using EFAME, using the Jessup principles on kind of smaller interagency jobs. It's knowing your kit, it's knowing your triage packs, it's building mental models about what you're going to do within that first 20 minutes should you find yourself on the scene. Where are you going to park? Where are your cards? How are you going to report? What is your plan as a crew? And I think that's really important. I think many of the lessons that have been identified, certainly around in Manchester and other inquests, have happened in the past. And in 2013, the Pollitt report was published, and it was commissioned to identify reoccurring failures of intrabot operability in the UK. Within the emergency services from past incidents. And the report identified the kind of common causes of failure, and that was inadequate training, ineffective communication, no systems to ensure that lessons were learned and staff taught those lessons, and that previous lessons or reports were not being acted upon. So for me, this really highlights that if organisations don't provide appropriate training to staff, that they communicate poorly or we communicate poorly on scene, and that we haven't learned from past incidents, that we're highly likely to repeat past failings when we're in the future, when we come to those scenes. And I suppose my final comment then is by Lord Taylor from the Hillsborough Stadium Disaster Inquiry. And he said it is a depressing and chastening fact that mine is the 9th official report covering crowd safety and control at football grounds. That it was allowed to happen despite all the accumulated wisdom of so many previous reports and guidelines must indicate that the lessons of past disasters and the recommendations following them had not been taken sufficiently to heart. There is no point in holding inquiries or publishing guidance unless the recommendations are followed diligently. That must be the first lesson.
And Alec, to yourself.
Yeah, I think obviously I'm hugely biased, but I think just sitting here and having this opportunity to talk about this stuff with yourself and Keir, it's really brought home my strong belief that there's a huge benefit from having critical care paramedics or APPs at these complex incidents with mass casualties. And I know in the Manchester report talked about the need for there always to be a physician, one of our medical colleagues, to be on scene, having the overall sort of clinical lead, if you like. And I think maybe I think there's clearly always going to be a role for our medical colleagues pre-hospitally. But actually, for me, I think having now talked about this a fair bit, I think it's actually less around your clinical role, but more about the most suitable person for that role at the time on that incident. And I think, as we talked about, you know, having the benefit of experienced solo clinicians with critical care, bringing agility to decision making and simple communication, having that self-determination to drive scenes and making the whole greater than the sum parts, it really makes a case for having advanced paramedic practitioners, critical care paramedics, solo critical care paramedics working autonomously in ambulance services and at these incidents, but also being able to work freely and dynamically within the scene, not having a predefined role. And again, we're very lucky that that is the case in London, and that's come about through not only 10 years of having the APP scheme, but a multitude of complex incidents and major incidents. And we're very fortunate that, you know, the expectation I think now would be for one of us to be at this type of job and you know, to work cohesively as part of that team. So I do think, you know, for people listening outside of people who work in ambulance services, but perhaps there isn't yet a critical care scheme developed within the ambulance service, I do think it's conversations like this to make a really good case for it. I think the other really pertinent thing to say is that I think it's so important to have these conversations. We talked about it before, but I think the biggest sort of injustice, I guess it touches exactly what Kiers just said, but when these incidents take place, Manchester bombing, London Bridge, to not sit down for all of us who work in the emergency services, who work in pre-hospital care, to sit down and look at all of the work that's gone into understanding why decisions were made and how we can all improve, and what would that be like if that happened in my system, in my service, you know, mental model, talk it through and to sim. I think that would be the real crime, would be to not be opportunistic around these sort of opportunities when they arise. So yeah, that would be my take home. And I think, yeah, kind of have it in your head, certainly from working in London, having it, you know, now for me, but I think if you're working in pre-hospital care, have it in your head that these situations will be a when and not an if. And then I think if you've got that mindset, then you'll always be better prepared for if you should find yourself in, you know, being that person either turning up first or in a clinical leadership role, you'll always be that slightly little bit ahead of the game. So yeah, that would be my take homes.
I just wanted to say thank you to both of you for the interview today. It's been fantastic just getting your insights and indeed your reflections on your anecdotal practice, but also the evidence and indeed the inquest recommendations and just putting all that together. So I just want to say thank you, both Keir and Alec.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.